There's a bitter family conflict when he joins the Irish Guard at the outset of World War I. Daniel Radcliffe plays Jack with Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City playing his mother. Tune in tonight at 9 p.m. on KRCB Television, Channel 22. The name of the program is Masterpiece Classic, My Boy Jack. You have attuned to KRCB-FM Santa Rosa. We're broadcasting at 91.1 and 90.9 FM, and we're streaming on the web at krcb.org. KRCB radio time is 7 o'clock. It's time for Mouthful.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid. Wait, sir. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys something. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
And now, I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Hope you've had a good weekend and thanks for tuning in. Nice weather. It was up in Healdsburg yesterday. Good turnout, it seemed like, for the Trout Unlimited, the Steelhead Trout Celebration. Walked around for a while, and without even realizing what I was doing, I sort of began to get ready for tonight's show. So I was walking past the booth of Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods, an organization that we've had here in Mouthful, and that I really wholeheartedly support. I think they do really good work. And to raise funds, one of the things they were doing was selling some stuffed animals, little stuffed animals and stuffed animal puppets. And I saw this really beautiful auburn bat, gorgeous. And I thought, you know, I have so many stuffed bats. If anybody found out, you know, they might want to, like, you know, put me under conservatorship or something. It's like, why do you have all these stuffed bats, Michelle? But I like bats. Anyway, right next to the bats was this amazing stuffed raven. It was a raven puppet, and then there was a little tiny raven next to it. And they both came home with me. And then I was thinking, it's like, well, Joel Peterson of Ravenswood is going to be on Mouthful on Sunday. What a coincidence. And I have on my raven earrings.
And they look very charming, I must say.
Well, thank you, Joel. And we were talking about this when you first got here. We both are fond of ravens.
We are. Ravens are an amazing bird. They are ubiquitous once you begin to focus on them, but they were very, very important to the Northwest Indians. The Inuits and others had Raven as a trickster god. He was essentially the equivalent of coyote in the Southwest. In this case, Raven found man in a pod on the beach and taught him how to survive and brought him light and fire and made woman and did all those really cool things that trickster gods do. And it seemed like an appropriate thing to do when I was in my first harvest and had to pick up the grapes myself and was accompanied by ravens to somehow acknowledge that.
By ravens?
Yes. I had two ravens that landed in the tree next to the truck where I was loading the grapes and sat there for the entire time, which ravens almost never do, and sort of cheered me on, if you will.
Really? Yep. And is that where that's not where... What inspired you to name?
Well, that inspired me to recognize the ravens. After all, I was living in Berkeley reading Carlos Castaneda and the Yaqui-Way and animal totems and that sort of thing. But I happen to like opera, and Lucia de Lammermoor is a really wonderful opera. Everybody dies. Lucia goes mad before she dies. But the erstwhile hero of this particular opera is Eduardo Ravenswood, and his fate is to wander in the moor and drown in the quicksand. Now, that's pretty angsty. But in fact, it was 1978. I'd done my first crush in 1976. I didn't have enough money to bottle anything. I was going broke. I just left my research job and moved up to Sonoma to take a job running the local clinical laboratory. And, you know, it looked like starting a small winery is a lot like drowning in the quicksand. Fortunately, the quicksand really wasn't very deep. But Ravenswood was a great name because it got the ravens and it got the angst, too.
Oh, what a great story. Now, there's something else about Ravenswood and Brooklyn. Tell me this story is amazing.
Yes. Well, we know that the lineage of Zinfandel is Croatia, and it's a grape in Croatia called Zirli, and it's Castellanski. And only recently, through the help of Charles Sullivan, did we find out sort of how it got here. So it went from Croatia to Austria, and from Austria it went to that hotbed of grape growing with a guy named George Gibbs, Queens, Long Island, New York. And I can actually tell you right where in Queens George Gibbs kept his greenhouses. They were in a neighborhood of Queens where there is now a gigantic Con Edison power plant. If you're like 125th Street and you look across the river, you'll see this power plant with this giant smokestacks. The real name of that power plant is the Con Edison power, the Ravenswood Con Edison power plant. And that is because it's right on top of George Gibbs' estate, which part of which he named Ravenswood Estate. So the first place that Ravenswood was named Ravenswood, and the first place that Zinfandel arrived were the same, and totally coincidentally.
So you didn't know this
my
at
winery.
The time?
Yeah, didn't know it at the time. I didn't know this until about 6 years ago. So totally coincidentally, Ravenswood is named Ravenswood, and the first place that Zinfandel arrived in the world, Ravenswood.
I love that story. I just love it. And we should say, if Joel Peterson is not a familiar name to you, think about Ravenswood and the Zinfandels that you have drunk. You have probably had his wines. And I think of you as the king of all things Zin. And I have for a long time, and I love that the Raven is connected with it. You're about to be inducted into the Vintners Hall of Fame.
I am.
February 24th.
February 21st.
Yeah. It's over at the Culinary Institute of America, Greystone in St. Helena.
That's correct. And this Hall of Fame has many of my wine heroes in it. People like Andre Chelichev and Amarine and Daryl Cordy and wonderful writers and wonderful winemakers. And I have to say that it comes as a bit of a surprise and certainly a great honor to be inducted into this.
Well, you have to be the only person that would be surprised by your induction. The only surprising thing is that it hasn't happened sooner. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. Really, I'm really looking forward to the ceremony. A lot of friends are coming, and it'll be very interesting to see what I look like in bronze.
So you are sitting in front of six bottles that look almost open.
Almost open, and we can certainly open one without any trouble at all.
Such a nice sound.
And so we have six bottles, and they come in various forms. One of the forms is kind of the color of Valentine's Day, since we're in that particular realm of the world. It's a rosé. We call it a rosato, not to be confused with a white Zinfandel, because I would not make a wimpy wine.
Yes, I can't imagine you making a white Zinfandel.
No, that's not going to happen. That was tried in 1983 when one of my partners asked me to make a white Zinfandel, and I told him I didn't do pink, and I didn't do sweet, and I didn't do wimpy. But it does turn out, you know, that I've actually done a little pink, because I happen to like dry rosé myself.
I really love dry rosé, actually. Yeah. I think it's a really food-friendly wine.
Yeah. And we don't send this wine far. It stays at the winery, but somehow it seemed appropriate for tonight. It's rosé made with Carignan and Grenache and Zinfandel.
It's really lovely.
Yeah. It's got a lot of the sort of, you know, bright Grenache qualities, that, you know, that bit of raspberry and that sort of, floral spice, which is very lovely.
Yeah, so, how long have you been doing a rosé, a risotto?
I've been making a risotto now for probably 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, it's one of those little things we do on the side. You know, it's nice to have something during the summer.
Sure.
Particularly when it gets hot.
I think it's nice during the winter, too.
I mean, when
it's
you
sort
can...
of foggy. It's, you know, white wines and really dry rosés, dry white wines, they just make me think of fog. And sometimes it's nice to have fog in a glass.
Absolutely. This one's got a little bit of savory quality at the end of it, so it actually goes pretty well with food.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things do you like to enjoy with it?
You know, there are lots of things. You know, it actually does pretty well with cheeses, and it does very nicely with sort of olives and that sort of fare. I generally have a rosé, not so much as a solid meal wine, but I usually have it before meal or when I'm sitting around just sort of snacking on things.
A nice aperitif wine.
I'm a red wine guy, as you know.
Yes.
You know, 95% of what I do is red. So, these are what I do for fun on the side. And they're nice to have around the house, you know, just sort of as an oeuvre to everything else that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Before we taste the next wine, let's just talk a little bit about the winery for people who haven't been there. Let's give them a lesson in geography.
Oh, well, we're talking about Sonoma County, of course.
Of course.
And we're talking about the southern end of Sonoma County. We're talking about one of the most famous towns in Sonoma County, which is the town of Sonoma, after which Sonoma County is named. And it was one of the first establishments in Sonoma County, in part because it was the farthest north of the mission settlements of the Franciscans. But it also was the location of General Vallejo. And in being the location of General Vallejo, who was actually sent north to Sonoma to keep the Russians from moving farther south.
Little did they know the gophers were going to take care of that.
It's true. In fact, I think Vallejo actually ended up selling produce to the Russians to keep them from starving to death. So, it was a funny turnaround. But between the missions and between Vallejo, there were grapes in Sonoma very early. And then, of course, Sonoma became known even more as a viticultural area because of Heresty,
right.
And his work and his book, actually, and then also his trip to Europe where he came back with many cuttings. So it's an interesting wine area, but it's the south part of Sonoma. It's an hour from the Golden Gate Bridge. And my winery is about half a mile off the downtown square. You can actually walk to it. And it's up a beautiful little road called Garrickey Road that everybody uses as their sort of walking path because it is so kind of non-trafficked and very pretty. And the tasting room is a smallish but very comfortable tasting room manned by people who absolutely love wine, love Ravenswood. Most of them have been there for a very long time. So you're talking to people with experience when you're there. And if you're lucky, or some people might say unlucky, you'll probably get somebody like George Becker, who was one of my original partners in 1979. And I think he is close to 79, and he still goes in
those
to work in the
tasting room. Those are the best tasting room people. I love that.
Yeah,
you get so many great history and great stories.
Yeah, he really loves people, and he loves to talk to people, and he loves to tell stories. So you get that sort of thing, and it's actually perfect at the end of the day.
Yeah. So you need someone in a tasting room who loves to tell stories. I remember the very first tasting room I ever went to when I came up here to I wanted to live here. I always wanted to live here, and I moved here as soon as I could to go to Sonoma State. And not very long after moving to Lakeville, went wine tasting. And the first place we went was Buena Vista. And that was at the time when the entire tasting room was in that back cave that I don't even think is open to visitors anymore. I don't think it has been for a very long time.
Yeah, I think they closed it down because of
the earthquake. Yeah, but that was where you went.
Wow.
Back in the cave. And there was this guy. He had to have been an actor. And he seemed ancient to us then. I mean, I was probably 21. And he would just tell the most amazing stories. We would just go there and stay 2 hours. And we went so often, he recognized us, and he was just always pulling out just great stories.
Wow.
I hope he was pulling out a few great bottles to go with him.
I remember more about the stories. But that is where I discovered, because I wasn't much into wine at all. But that's where it's like, oh, I really like red wine.
Well, we have a character at our tasting room whose name is Uncle Bob. And Uncle Bob actually has an evening that he actually, you know, if people want to stay late at the tasting room, he will open up special bottles and tell stories.
Really?
Yeah, he's quite the character.
Is there a set time when he does that?
You know, it varies.
Okay.
Tuesday evenings is not an unusual time for him to do it, but it's not guaranteed. So phone and find out when Uncle Bob's doing his special lectures.
Oh, God, that's so great. What a nice thing to know about. You're in the Sonoma Valley Appalachian, right?
We are the Sonoma Valley Appalachian.
No, do any other Appalachians overlap?
With Sonoma Valley? Yeah, we have Sonoma Mountain, which is really part of the Sonoma Valley Appalachian. Mm-hmm. You know, and Ravenswood, of course, uses all of Sonoma County.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if the location, if like Sonoma, if you're in also in Sonoma Coast or also in Carneros.
There is the south end of Sonoma Valley, which is Carneros. And Sonoma Coast catches us as well. So there are lots of sort of appellations that overlap. Some are more specific. So Sonoma Mountain, for instance, would be probably smaller and more specific than Sonoma Valley. The Carneros, of course, runs both in Napa and Sonoma. Mm-hmm. So the southern end of Sonoma Valley is Sonoma Carneros also, which is that piece that runs right along the bay. So we have really unique and sort of special climates. It was an area that was thought to be a good grape-growing area very early. People like William McPherson Hill, General Joseph Hooker, of all people, was there. You know, Hooker planted a vineyard in 1860 with some land that he purchased, and that vineyard became known as Madrone Vineyard. And I make a wine called Borussia, which is a fragment of that vineyard that was owned by two women, Barbara and Patricia.
Oh.
And Barbara and Patricia, obviously, is a contraction of their names to make the name Borussia. But Pat Heron is a Superior Court judge, and she's quite the interesting woman. And she loves to tell the story about Hooker and how Hooker was known for things other than the fact that he was a Civil War general and the fact that he went to Mexico and got California and Texas and Arizona and New Mexico for the United States with the Treaty of Hidalgo. She says that he encouraged camp followers who became known as Hooker's girls because he believed men fought better in battle if they had the company of women, or Hookers for short. And then she likes to point out that she and Barbara are a long way from Hooker's girls, and they probably make General Hooker very uncomfortable. It gives her a little pride and satisfaction.
Now, that's a story I had not heard before. Hooker's girls. That is too good. So you're about to open another wine there, and I don't want to delay you.
I am. Well, yeah. Never delay when a bottle of wine is at ready. So this bottle of wine is from that other four-letter valley, and it is a Zinfandel, and it's from the 2008 vintage, which was
lovely. Give me the
vintage.
Label here.
This is from my County Series wines. This is a wine that has been sort of a standard of Ravenswood for a long time. We make wines that are more specific in flavor based on where they're from. We think that, you know, wine should represent the grape and the place. And this is Napa, but we also make a Sonoma Zinfandel, and we also make a Lodi Zinfandel. They're all made the same way, but they all taste very different from one another.
Different.
And this one's all about berries and spice and plums. And the reason that I brought this one is I was talking to David today, and I said, okay, what's been selling in the taste room well for Valentine's Day? What do couples like when they come in here? And he said, you know, there are a couple of wines that have been really good for us this week. One of them has been the Napa Zin, and the other has been the Big River, which we'll try next. And finally, the Muscat, which we have here as well. So This wine is all about what Zinfandel is supposed to be about. It's got the fruit up front. It's got the spice. It's got just enough tannin to be interesting with food. It's got acid. And while I think you should probably sin with Zin, I don't think that, you know, Zin should have what I consider the three deadly sins of Zinfandel, which are too much sugar and too much oak and too much alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree. Bless you.
And this wine is devoid of all those sins. It's got
absolutely.
It's got the essence of Zinfandel.
Yeah, it really does. And it has very nice mouthfeel from the beginning. It's just really silky. It's a very pretty wine.
Yeah, which is not what people generally say about Zinfandel.
No, they don't.
What they usually say is, oh, this is a big, massive, over-the-top kind of wine.
Yeah. No, I'd heard something probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago that really surprised me. It was as, you know, the big Zinfandel.
Yeah, Zap.
Zap. Yeah, of course, Zap. Somebody was saying, well, Zinfandel has fallen out of favor. And there was this whole thing about nobody admitted to drinking Zinfandel anymore, and it wasn't considered a very good wine. And it's like, I really haven't been living under a rock, but I hadn't heard anything like that.
You know,
what's the deal?
It's really interesting. I would say that the 10,000 people came to Zap didn't feel that way about it. You know, you hear this every once in a while. In fact, I keep an article on my wall that was written in the New York Times probably 30 years ago now, about the time I was starting making Zinfandel, that said the same exact thing. Zinfandel really has fallen into disfavor. The wines are really too big and awkward and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, it's a shame because it can be such a nice wine. You know, so somebody lamenting the demise of Zinfandel.
30 years ago.
But, you know, when we started Zap, and I was one of the founding members of Zap, we found 10 wineries that we thought were producing pretty good Zinfandel. We put on our first tasting 20 years ago. And we managed to get 50 people to come to that tasting. Now, half of them were from the winery, so you couldn't count it as much of a success. Today, there are, you know, 250 to 300 wineries that come. They're pouring, on average, 3 wines apiece. And you have, you know, anywhere between 9 and 10,000 people that come to taste. I would say that Zinfandel has gone up in credibility and value. You also look at the growth of Zinfandel over those years. It's been growing steadily now for many years, but between 7% and 9%, which is, just really good, solid, steady growth. Mm-hmm. And it just means that there are people out there who find it credible.
Yeah, I was so surprised when I read that because, you know, I try to stay up on all things wine since I do write about it. Mm-hmm. And that was just something that never made it onto my radar at all. One thing I'm curious about, especially, I mean, you're such a resource. And you hear so much talk about the increase in alcohol possibly being a result of climate change, you know, all that sort of thing. And I get, as somebody who writes about wine, I get an awful lot of wines that are between 15 and 16% alcohol. So what's your take on that whole issue?
Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Now, if you're talking about Cabernet or some of the other reds besides Zinfandel, that becomes a stylistic issue. Mm-hmm. And I believe that a lot of that has to do with critics. Critics tend to evaluate wines that are higher in alcohol, higher in oak, and actually higher in sugar, more highly, interestingly enough. It's very odd, but I think it's sort of an outcome of the kinds of tastings they do, where they taste many wines.
Many wines, and something that actually gets through when you're tasting 500 wines makes an impression.
It does. And so if they get high scores, they sell, because people buy wines that
based
have high
scores.
It's, you know, there's only so many ways you can sort through, you know, 6,000 wines. Mm-hmm. And one of them is to use other people's notes and scores. So wine makers are not dumb. They recognize that if those wines sell, they can make those wines. So there are more of those wines that are being made. They tend to be big. They tend to be sweet. They tend to be oaky. And they tend to be high in alcohol because to get the kind of flavors that are those really ripe flavors, and we do like ripe fruit as human beings. There's no doubt that we're drawn to it. You have to get the grapes pretty ripe.
Mm-hmm.
With Zinfandel, it's a slightly different phenomenon because Zinfandel is a grape that has uneven ripeness. My first wines in 1976 were 14.5% and 15.2% alcohol. So sort of right in that zone. Mm-hmm. And it's my opinion, and I think a lot of people's opinion, that unless a Zinfandel is between 13.5% and 15 degrees alcohol, what it means is you've either picked it underripe or you picked it overripe. But being an uneven ripening grape means that the cluster has slightly withered berries, perfectly ripe berries, and slightly underripe berries on every cluster. And those slightly withered berries tend to provide you with more sugar. But if you don't have them on the cluster, you don't have that little, what I call, seigneur on the cluster. And you don't get the concentration or the flavor density. And as a consequence, the wines can be rather thin and pretty uninteresting. I mean, if you like a Beaujolais-style Zinfandel, that's great. But if you're looking for a good, solid table wine, it's going to be in that neck of the woods. Interestingly enough, I was reading a rather old wine book that was published in the 1920s, and they were talking about alcohol and wine as well. And it seems that California has always had relatively high alcohols in their wines, whether they were Mission grapes or the new reds or whatever it was. So
it's not really a modern, a contemporary occurrence.
This is
something that's been pervasive.
It comes and it goes. Back in the 50s, it was less. But with the popularity of wine and what people's tastes are, it's tended to go up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I had a friend who's actually just put himself a vineyard together, and he's hired a consultant. And I heard him tell the consultant that he wanted a wine that was big and had high alcohol. That was his desire.
On that note, I think we'll take a little musical break here on Mouthful.
Well, I saw you sitting there. I was trying. Yeah.
You're listening to Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. My guest this evening, the soon-to-be-inducted into the Vintners Hall of Fame, Joel Peterson of Ravenswood Winery, and the king of all things Zinfandel. We could go on. We could probably talk until midnight just based on what you know off the top of your head about this grape.
Well, that would be great. I would love to do that, only because I was talking to you, not necessarily because I like talking about Zinfandel. Oh, wait a minute. That's not true. I do like talking about Zinfandel.
Yes.
And if you like talking about Zinfandel or hearing about Zinfandel, I could certainly talk about it.
Yes, you can. And I mean, one time you were on, you talked about there's a patch. I don't know if patch is the right word, but there's a place over in Napa where you've planted, where there has been planted a lot of different clones of the research vineyard or something?
Yes, this is the Heritage Vineyard Project,
right.
That I've been working on now for 10 years with UC Davis, Jim Wolpert, and his crew. And it's a wonderful project, and in fact, it's just coming to fruition. Your timing on this question is perfect.
Good.
So this is a project where we went out and selected 90 selections of Zinfandel from vines all planted before 1920, because Davis had been beaten up pretty badly about the selections of Zinfandel that were available for propagation. Some said that the clusters were as big as the state of Texas, and the grapes were as big as oranges. Now, that may have been an exaggeration, but it's why people thought we had white Zinfandel, and we really didn't have great red Zinfandel. So they went out trying to find a variation or a selection that would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So they selected these 90, they put them in the ground at the Oakville station, and then they did another selection based on good variation and virus testing to make sure that they didn't have virus. Put another 20 in the ground that they had selected from their original 90, and began studying those. And we began looking at things like how they grew, what their cluster weight was, how much raisining they had, what the berry size was, and what kind of wine they made. So we've been doing that for 10 years, and we've got this wonderful database. And this year we will be releasing, and this was a Zap project too, I might add. Zap has supported this through their auction. We'll be releasing 19 selections of budwood, of different clonal variations of Zinfandel. And Sunridge Nursery is kind enough to have propagated all of them. So people will be able to get really good budwood when they plant new vineyards. Budwood that is certified, that is clean, that has some variation that, in fact, they know something about. There's never been a project done like this with any grape in California at all.
Mm-hmm.
We know about clonal variation in Pinot Noir. We know about clonal variation in Cabernet. We even know a little bit about clonal variation in Sangiovese, but we know very little about the variation within Zinfandel, and now we know much more.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a great project,
uh-huh.
And ultimately it would lead, in the long run, I think, to better Zinfandel. It will give people who are planting vineyards in Zinfandel maybe a little bit more encouragement to plant Zinfandel,
mm-hmm.
and they can plant with heritage clones that really do have a history. And, so within that, while we don't tell people what clone is what, because we want them to choose the clones based on their propensities, it's got wonderful vineyards. It's got the Litton Spring Vineyard in it. It's got the Old Hill Vineyard in it. It's got the Doozy Ranch in it. It's got the Duprat Vineyard in it. So these are all quite famous old Zinfandel vineyards in California that actually have made lovely wine over the years.
Mm-hmm, cool. So you just popped the cork on the Johnny Cash wine, Big River.
Big River, yes indeed.
I should have had that song handy, but I did not.
Yes, this is one of my favorite Zinfandels, in part because it's 100% Zinfandel. And that's highly unusual for vineyards this old. This is a vineyard planted around 1900. It's due east of Healdsburg, right along the Russian River. It's in that very funny, strange place on the Russian River where it comes out of the Alexander Valley, and the river actually heads a little bit to the east and to the south,
mm-hmm.
and then it says, oops, I've made a mistake here. I can't get out that way.
And
then it comes all the way back north, and then it finds its way back around to the south and out to the west, mm-hmm. where it goes into the Russian River Valley. And right on this peninsula, right on top of this peninsula, is Big River Vineyard. It used to be called Black Mountain. And It's 100% Zinfandel planted in this wonderful red soil. So when you taste this wine, you're really tasting the essence of pure Zinfandel. I actually brought another wine called Belloni, which is actually a mixed black wine planted at the same time in the Russian River. So I thought it'd be fun for us to compare the two of them. So what do you think of this?
I think it's I'm going to try it again before I say.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to, you know, it's really pretty. I mean, I feel, just feel like I'm failing in with vocabulary, but it's got an ethereal quality that, I mean, that's a word that I will use more often with Pinot Noir,
mm-hmm.
but this actually has an ethereal quality that is very engaging, and it's that ethereal quality combined with a silkiness on the palate that almost always leads me to use the term pretty.
Yeah,
but it is. It's not, certainly not wimpy on any level. It fills your mouth. There's spice. There is Santa Rosa plum combined with some very, very ripe mangosteen, mm-hmm. which you don't see that often and which I'm extremely fond of. There's even a little bit of licorice root. But I think it's very, very pretty.
Well, licorice root is actually one of the hallmarks of this particular vineyard.
Oh.
Pat yourself on the back. It shows up over and over again in this vineyard. But I think you've actually hit on something that most people don't know. When most people drink Zinfandel, they think of it as a big bruising wine, in part because people get it very, very ripe. But it was not classified that way when it came into California. When it came into California, people did sort of breakdowns for the sake of the growers that are planting them, you know, like, you know, grapes that were, you know, delicate, grapes that were sort of medium in body, grapes that were heavy in body and weight and had lots of color. And it turned out that Zinfandel was never categorized in the big category. Mm-hmm. It was always categorized in sort of the lower end of the medium category.
Mm-hmm.
So it was meant to be a grape that was kind of like, I suppose, an uber Pinot Noir, if you will. It's not like a big Cabernet necessarily. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't play in that same kind of pyrazine, green, heavy-duty, tannic quality.
No, it doesn't.
It tends to be more in, you know, spice and raspberries and those kinds of things. So this wine is, being 100% Zinfandel, shows those things mm-hmm. off. Now, when phylloxera were hit in the late 1870s, and they replanted those vineyards, people thought, well, we need to beef it up in certain ways. Maybe we need more acid. Maybe we need more tannin. Maybe we need more color in some vineyards. And so they planted grapes like Petit Sirah and Carignan and Alicante Boucher to compensate for that. And in fact, they developed, particularly here on the North Coast, in what they called the Sonoma Viticultural District, which was Sonoma, Napa, and Mendocino. You know, I'm sure the people in Napa would not be happy to hear that. They were called Sonoma once. Was to make a wine that they called Claret or mm-hmm. Bordeaux or Burgundy. And that is, you know, basically a mixed black field blend. And it was really the best wine California made before Prohibition by far.
So, well, I think this is really a beautiful wine. I would definitely drink this.
Well, I am delighted. And you should drink it. And you should drink it with food. I mean, it's really terrific
yes.
with food. You know, most people think that Zinfandel goes well with grilled meats, and they like to think about it as barbecue wine. And, yeah, yes, indeed, it does go very well
sure.
with that. But Zinfandel also works very well with Mediterranean food of many sorts. So Southern French cuisine and Zinfandel are like heaven. You know, those garlicky, spicy kinds of flavors. I'm going to pour another wine here just to
okay.
rush us on,
I'll pour my big river out.
Not because I want you to drink faster, but because I want you to see the difference between mm-hmm. these two wines. Now, so these wines are made exactly the same way. They're small open top fermenters, punched down by hand, native yeast fermentations.
Literally by hand?
By hand, yeah.
Oh, cool. Bless you.
There's a punch that we use. But
are
I
there?
Mean,
okay.
But, I mean, there's
is
there's
it
a
one of those hydraulic things
there's
that
a body
you use?
On the end of the punch.
There is, good.
Yeah.
And I always thought that would be a great job, punch down.
It's a great job for about the first tank, and then you start getting really sweaty.
It's really good for your triceps.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to love, you know, doing it when I was actually doing it myself because, mm-hmm. you know, the bad habits of winemakers make them kind of chubby and let's just say less than robust. And there's nothing like a good season of punching down to get you back into form. It works out quite nicely. But this wine was planted at the same time. This is Belloni Vineyard. It's a vineyard that comes from the Russian River, also 1900, also made the same way. By the way, both these wines spend 18 months in French oak. I use French oak because I think it doesn't overwhelm the character mm-hmm. of the grape itself. So this wine actually has some of those mixed blacks in it. So you can see the difference. You can mm-hmm. look at the color.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the color is, you know, is different. You know, this one has a little Alicante Boucher in it. You can see that it's got much more of the kind of boysenberry, you know, qualities in the nose, and it's got, you know, slightly different flavors in the finish.
Uh-huh. And it fills the mouth differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more forward stimulation of the palate.
Yeah, it feels fuller.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel quite as bright and linear.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the Big River was thin or anything. We just it has this really kind of clarity going through it. This one ends up kind of feeling bigger and fatter. Mm-hmm. It's not jammy, but it's bigger.
No,
and
it's
fatter.
Not jammy, but it definitely tastes darker.
Yes,
you know, it tastes darker. Yeah. And I would not say at all. I would not say licorice root.
Mm-mm.
I might say small black licorice coins.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
But not licorice root.
Definitely not licorice root.
Yeah. I'm a licorice connoisseur.
I can see.
It's one of my favorite flavors.
I'm not sure I could have separated those flavors myself. But, you know, I grew up in a household where we thought about flavor a lot. You know, I had a mother who was a nuclear chemist to...
Where was this?
Point Richmond, of all places.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yeah, over the hill from what was then the largest oil refinery in the world.
Yeah.
Both my parents were chemists. My mother was a nuclear chemist. My father was a physical chemist who worked on greases. And my mother discovered wine in 1952. Actually, it was 1951 when she went and got a bottle of 1945 Chateauneuf du Pape for Thanksgiving.
Where did she buy that?
She bought it at the City of Paris, in the cellar of the City of Paris.
You've told me this story before.
And so she brought it home, and that turned, really, they had it for Thanksgiving. That turned my parents into wine fanatics, really. You know, being chemists, they dissected everything and wanted to examine it. My mother was also a wonderful cook. She was learning to cook. And
Don't you have some files of recipes of hers?
I do have some files of recipes. In fact, I have, you know, unfortunately, my mother passed away a couple of years ago, but she left us like this massive wall of cookbooks, all annotated by hand.
Oh.
You know, she ended up kind of reworking Alice Waters' recipes in her first book so that they would work in a home kitchen. So she really edited
that Chez Panisse menu cookbook.
Yeah, the Chez Panisse menu cookbook, uh-huh. Exactly. So, yeah, my mother's handiwork can be seen there. She could just take, like, stuff out of the refrigerator and turn it into this amazing meal, even if it was, like, you know, leftovers or just fragments mm-hmm. of things. It was pretty
amazing.
She
was a cook.
Yeah,
she
was a
natural cook.
Yeah. So in the process of teaching me to, or teaching themselves to learn about wine and enjoy wine, they actually taught me about wine. And my father would sit down with, you know, wine, and he'd say, well, what's the smell like? And I might say, it smells like apples. And then he'd go out and he'd find apples. And he'd chop up apples and he'd put them in glasses and he'd say, okay, can you tell the difference between Golden Delicious and Rome Beauty and Northern Spy or whatever? And so I got a real training in sort of organoleptic work that actually most people don't. You know,
no kidding, that's remarkable. Yeah,
we learn to use our eyes, we learn to use our ears, we learn to use our tongue to talk, but rarely do we use our tongue to taste things or our nose to smell things. And I've done this with my children, and, you know, I have a 30-year-old son now who started his own winery.
Oh, really? What winery?
Called Bedrock Wine Company. Remarkably, he's like the hottest little winery in the universe right now. He's doing very well. He's a really nice kid, but he's a kid. He's 30 years old. He's not a kid. But he is a dissertation away from being an MW. So clearly, tasting early didn't hurt him either.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Cool and really interesting.
He learned a lot of things. So It's a good thing. And in fact, if you have kids, I highly recommend that. Not necessarily you make them taste wine or anything, but that in fact you give them the opportunity to smell subtle differences between things. You know, do citrus fruits, do do apples, do lemons, you know, or do herbs of one variety or spices.
Because it's a really great idea.
It's great fun for them, and it really gives them another way to perceive the world.
Opens something up.
For me, when I go to different cities, they smell different. Yeah, when I go in different rooms, you know, with different kinds of people, you smell different kinds of scents. You can almost smell anxiety. It's really interesting. So using your nose is not a bad thing to have happen.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. So when I was talking about these wines, I was talking a little bit about mixed blacks and claret and Burgundy and Bordeaux. Well, this next wine is really what I call the once and future wine of California. It's my icon. And that's the name of the wine, by the way. It's also my icon. But it's all vineyards planted before 1900. None of them are 100% varietal.
Okay.
Or even 75% varietal. It wouldn't qualify as a varietal wine. It's really a combination of Petit Syrah and Carignan, Alicante, Boucher, and Zinfandel, with a little Syrah and Grenache and a few other things in it, because that's the way these fields were planted. So it is the wine that I think would have made California famous if it hadn't been for Prohibition. It would have been our Chateauneuf du Pape or our Bordeaux or our Chianti. Essentially grapes chosen by the people of the region through trial and error to make what they considered the best wine that they could make. That went well with their culture and their food. And so this is really the true California wine, if you will, at least certainly for the northern part of the state. And there's no other blend like it in the world. And it is definitely right there in the top wines of the world, in my opinion. When you taste this wine, you can see that it's got density and structure and wonderful spice and aromatics that are,
It's much deeper in color, a lot more color than the two previous ones.
But it still has the perfume and the complexity, but it's beyond just Zinfandel.
Yeah, it's so different than the others.
It's got a little more structure. Now, I like structure because I think it's a sign of how a wine will age and will develop with time.
What vintage is this?
This is the 07 vintage.
Okay.
I began making this wine with the 07 vintage. I actually made one of these for my 25th anniversary back in 1999, and it's remarkable now. It's a terrific wine. It's, in fact, my winemaking team's favorite wine. When they go out to dinner and they want to wow their friends, they take a bottle of this wine with them.
So of 1999, really cool.
The
99,
Icon? Yeah, Icon.
That was a great year. I mean, it's just a year that sounds good to say.
Yes.
Just before the millennium.
Yes. Another song I should have had.
Exactly. That would have been perfect.
No, it's not available.
What, the 99?
Yeah.
No. Only for special people who show up at the winery and when I'm open one of the few bottles I have left. I think I have a case and a half left of it.
Wow.
So it doesn't come out very often.
Yeah, I guess not.
Although I actually will be serving that. I actually pulled out a couple of cases of it, which is why I only have a case and a half left, for the Vintners Hall of Fame tasting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they ask for a wine, and I thought that would be a worthy one.
Wow. So is there a walk-around tasting at that event? How does it work?
There's a walk-around tasting. There's also dinner. Many of the wines will be served were wines that have historically been served at the White House because the White House chef will be cooking.
The White House chef is cooking the dinner?
Yeah. So
the current White House chef?
No, it's one of the past.
Is it Walter?
Yeah, it's Walter, yeah.
Oh, well, okay.
So it should.
Well, and we should say, so we don't sound like we're being all in crowdy. It's Walter Scheib, who was the chef during the Clinton, when the Clintons were there, and then he worked for the Bushes for a while, but Laura Bush invited him to leave. And he published a book.
Yes.
And I wrote a column about his book because a previous White House chef had written a book, Rene Verdun.
Mm-hmm. Who just recently passed away.
Yeah. I think on the 3rd, maybe on the 3rd of February. And I consider him one of my top mentors.
Well, he was so key to changing the way Americans ate. I mean, Jackie O and he, along with Julia Child and some other people. But it was all during that era when we began to look at food differently.
Yes. And I think so much of it had to do with Jackie Kennedy. And, I mean, she was such a Francophile.
She was.
And she interviewed Rene Verdun in French when she was interviewing somebody, I forget who it was, a chef at a big hotel restaurant in New York recommended Rene to her when she was looking for a chef. And she interviewed him, but she interviewed him in French and invited him to come. And his, his book, The White House Chef Cookbook, is interesting for several reasons. All kinds of reasons. But one of the things that's just so endearing and engaging is, in a subtle and very respectful way, it's a love letter to the Kennedys.
Yes.
And I love that about it. I was very sad to read that he had died.
Can you imagine having a French chef in the White House now? I mean, it would be a wonderful thing, but, the consternation.
Oh, my gosh.
I can hear Rush Limbaugh now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Couldn't they find an American that could cook?
Yeah. Well, if Obama had a French chef, gosh. Yeah.
Well, but in truth, food and cuisine and all those things have gotten so much better in the United States. Really, I've ridden the wave of wine and food culture in the United States, and it's been pretty remarkable. So, actually, Jackie Kennedy wouldn't have to find a French chef to get good food.
No, she wouldn't. She certainly did then. I mean, she really changed. If you go back and read some of the earlier White House menus, oh my, I mean, she really did transform how food was prepared and served in the White House.
Yeah.
And that just trickled down. And I mean, and the timing with Julia Child was perfect because Julia was there on TV teaching everybody how to do what Jackie was doing in the White House. So it was really ideal.
It's true. And then you had, people like Alice Waters show up at exactly the right
moment. Exactly.
And transform what Julia had done to a much more sort of locally based cuisine.
Exactly.
That was remarkably fresh and used fresh local ingredients.
Yeah.
And was, while method was important, method was really kind of secondary.
Yeah, it was secondary to ingredients.
To great ingredients.
Yeah.
Which is the way it should be with great wine. I mean, I think method's important and it has to be right. But at the end of the day, it's secondary to
the grapes.
And what you have there. And speaking of method, we've got another wine here that we probably ought to try. This one is, let me rinse your glass, because this one is not the same color as the others. This one happens to be, as you can see, just a bit fizzy in the bottle. This is my Moscato Leggero. It's made from Muscat of Alexandria and Muscat Canelli.
And it's got this very whimsical label.
Well,
with the birds. I love the birds on the glass, and you did the label.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a really, both the Rosato and the Moscato have different labels. The Rosato is more like, Matisse cutouts, and the Rosato is this kind of, or Moscato is kind of this whimsical thing, because we wanted it to be different than, the sort of core Ravenswood wines. Our logo is so well known, and it becomes very dominant on the label. It's also the most tattooed logo, out there.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no.
A lot of people have the Ravenswood tattoo.
Yeah, we have an annual Ravenswood tattoo party at the winery, and people show up with their tattoos, and there's an award for the best tattoo. And
when is that party?
I'm not sure when it's going to be this year. It's usually at the end of the summer. Kristen advertises it heavily, so you don't have to look far to find it. I don't think she's set the date yet. But people come on a regular basis. We have people who modify their tattoos, so they'll have an opportunity.
So they can compete again.
We have a wonderful woman with a tattoo with sort of tramp stamp position, it was just the regular logo. And then she surrounded it with this like flaming red mandala the next year. So it was pretty amazing. Yeah, pretty remarkable stuff. So,
how many people attend that? I mean, are we talking a couple dozen? Are we talking scores?
Well, we're talking a couple of dozen real tattoos, but we also have the people who come for their temporary tattoos. We have a temporary tattoo artist there, and they come to taste the wines. And so it's probably 120, 130 people that end up showing up for that day.
It sounds like a really fun party.
And we have a good time. Yeah. So completely different note on this wine. You know, a little bit of gardenia, more floral, slightly orange notes. Yeah.
Really floral. Yeah. And I love the slight effervescence that just punctuates everything really nicely.
And it's a little bit sweet, but not so sweet that you say, oh, that's heavy sweet.
No, it's not heavy sweet. It's sweet. But part of what makes that sweetness engaging is the effervescence.
Yes.
That's really nice.
Yes.
What would you, what if somebody wanted to have this tomorrow Valentine's Day?
They'd have to run down to Ravenswood because it's the only place you can
get it.
We sell it only at the winery.
What do you like to enjoy it with?
Just somebody else.
Okay. Good enough for me.
you can have it with all sorts of light desserts and sweet things. It goes fabulously well with strawberries dipped in chocolate. It does amazing things with peaches. When we had a winery chef, the winery chef used to take peaches, and he would cut up peaches and nectarines, and then he would soak them in this Moscato Leggero. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, terrific. It was really good. Yeah.
I can imagine this being good with certain... Maybe I could be wrong, but with certain triple cream cheeses in the right context.
I think you'd be absolutely right about that. It's got enough acidity, so it works quite nicely.
And on that note, we're out of time, Joel.
How'd that happen?
Time flies on Mouthful, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
It really does. And we didn't even get... I really wanted to sort of explore the whole idea of red wine and chocolate and see what you thought about that. That just means you're going to have to come back.
I think I could be persuaded.
Cool. And again, congratulations on your induction into the Vintners Hall of Fame over at the CIA, taking place February 21st. Ravenswood.com, is that right?
Ravenswood-wine.com.
Dash wine.com.
You can also go to Facebook and find No Wimpy Wines on Facebook.
No Wimpy Wines.
And you can sign the petition against Wimpy Wines, and you can become one of our fans, friends, and have a good time with us.
That's the other thing we have to do next time you come is talk about what is a wimpy wine.
We can do that.
Okay.
I've got all sorts of things. Baryshnikov is not a wimpy ballet dancer, but he is also not a Harley Davidson rider.
On that note, meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. We will be talking about Chinese New Year, as we do every year about this time. Have a great week and stay dry. It's going to rain.
The Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now. Let's go eat. We've got some beans and some good cornbread.
Mouthful is hosted and produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast at krcb.org or from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, well, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too, and he'll sing to the Lord.